everything gonna be alright. Oh yeah. When I was a little girl, only 12 years old,
that's the great Coco Taylor, queen of the blues, with I'm a Woman. It was her response to Bo Diddley's I'm a Man. That's from her 1978 album, The Earthshaker, released by Alligator Records. Coco Taylor was inducted into the Blues Hall of Fame in 1997 and won the Blues Music Award 25 times, more than any other artist, including in categories for Contemporary Blues, Female Artist, Entertainer of the Year, Female Artist, Traditional Blues Female Artist, and Vocalist of the Year. In 1999, the Blues Foundation honored her with a Lifetime Achievement Award. Born Cora Walton in Shelby County, Tennessee, Coco Taylor died in her beloved Chicago, where her professional career began, on June the 3rd, 2009. She was 80 years old. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Tuesday, March the 10th. And today I want to talk about being a woman. From a personal point of view, I call it Notes on an Evolution, because it's a process of evolution, after all. All societies exert extraordinary power and influence in shaping not only an aggregate or collective identity, but the individual identity as well. Social rules, we use that word because that's what they are. Some of these rules are static, some of them are dynamic and ever-changing, but they define, nonetheless, widely held customs and values and beliefs, how we relate to each other, and how we see ourselves in the context of the whole. American society is no exception, although it likes to think that it is. But in this regard, it is not an exception. Even with social rules that are shifting and a political and cultural history deeply rooted in race and class ideation and conflict, who decides what is the collective identity? Who decides, consequently, what is individual identity? And in this framework, what does being a woman mean? Well, it is Women's History Month, and I thought, giving a nod to Women's History Month, I'll talk about the subject from my own point of view. As you know, I was born and raised in Trinidad, the island of perfect people. I say that because it's so far from the truth, not at all the truth. But that's where I was born, and that's where I was raised. And I was born in a pretty, well, by comparative standards, a pretty large family. But by our standards, where I was born, it's a modest family of nine or seven brothers, one sister, and typical for us, we had two parents. So I was born in a household with an oversupply of testosterone. Eight men in the house. And I grew up in a colonial culture. Well, in a sense, you could call it post-colonial, but it really wasn't so post when I was coming along. It was still very much a colonial culture. In school, for example, my elementary school, we were taught, we had to go to the basement of the school, we looked forward to it, to be taught about our culture by radio fusion, or radio fusion radio, from the BBC. An Englishman someplace in Britain was educating us about our culture, as the British desired us to know our culture. We didn't know, we weren't taught the beauty and the wonder and the gloriousness of our own culture. It was not desirable because it was inferior. So we were groomed to hate it, to despise it, and to long to belong to that group that was as close to Britain as possible. In high school, for example, we were taught cooking. We called it cookery. And in cookery, which was, of course, to prepare the girls, I went to an all-girls school, to prepare the girls to be good homemakers and housekeepers. And in that process, we learned how to make shepherd's pie and things like I'm forgetting these things because I so desperately wanted to, but trifle for dessert and things like that, very, very British things that supposedly growing into women we would make these things for our families. We did not know how to make a proper roti, which is what it is we ought to have learned. How to make an outstanding pilau. How to make a righteous kalaloo. We were learning how to be British, how to adopt the ways of our colonizer, because we were to fit into a predetermined cog in their wheel. And of course, Trinidad and Tobago, like most of the Caribbean, had been transformed for centuries into the working laboratory of wealth for Britain. And everything and everyone fit into that wheel somehow. And even after colonial days were, quote, over, unquote, and Trinidad became independent, at least theoretically, that still remained because the education had been so thorough to make us compliant with an alien culture, an alien existence, even in our own country. And then I came to the United States and had to learn an entirely different kind of reality and how to maneuver it and how to maintain a certain sanity in this culture. So from a colonial culture dominated by the British to another kind of colonial culture dominated by Americans. And here in the United States, it was amazing to me, the adjustments that one had to make quickly. You had to read the landscape quickly and accurately, because if you misstepped, it could be pretty dangerous for you. It could be pretty costly. It could set you back quite a bit. And it did me. I remember sitting across a table from a white woman who was evaluating my educational credentials in order to determine where and how to place me. I should have gone to college, but off the bat she said that I was too young to go to college. And she began to ask me about my grades, and everything was there before her to make sense of who I was, at least academically. And well into the conversation, she said, to my astonishment, she asked me, "Do you speak English?" I went within my head, "Oh, Lord. I am in the hands of a moron. And this moron is in a position to affect my life. Please, God, help me." Well, God didn't help me then. He kind of had other things to do. And so I was sentenced to high school. I, according to the evaluator, needed grounding in American history, and for that I was sentenced to high school all over again. So my educational ambitions were stymied immediately. I went, and my life continued just the same. But that experience taught me how to intervene when my two younger brothers came, and what to do to prevent them from going through the same process. That was my introduction to America. For no reason whatsoever, I was just sentenced. I was just interrupted. My path was just interrupted by somebody who had the power and authority to do that. And that person happened to be a woman, a white woman. And there was no way to counteract that. Her word was final and correct as far as the system was concerned. She was wrong, but that was her word. Years later, when I became the founder and editor of the City Sun, a wonderful little newspaper, I was invited back to the same school to give a talk. And by then, the school's population was dramatically different. It was Erasmus Hall High School in Brooklyn. A fellow Trinidadian who was also a graduate of Erasmus Hall had invited me to come speak. the auditorium was crammed, parents and students and teachers. And on the stage, where I was, were the officials and administrators and the principal. And we are overlooking this crammed auditorium. And I thought, as a novel idea, I would ask the question, which teacher here believes that he or she has in a classroom or his classroom a student who would go on to do great things? I asked a question really to stimulate a kind of back and forth and to get parents to see their children being pointed out by their teachers as children of promise. And to my amazement, and to the utter amazement of those of us on stage, not a single hand went up. Not one. I asked a question again. Who is teaching a child right now who will go on to do great things? And again, not a single hand went up. And of course, I went ballistic. And I said to the parents particularly, this is what you are doing to your children every day without knowing it. In good faith, you bring your children to be educated so that they can have a shot at life. They'll be able to compete. They'll be able to realize their modest hopes and dreams and aspirations. And they are placed in the hands of people who have no faith at all, nor any expectation that they will go on to do great things. We are witnessing before our eyes today educational genocide. Well, of course, I wasn't invited back. The principal was mad at me for the fact that none of the teachers, and they were mostly white, none of the teachers believed that the children, any of the children that they were educating, had within them the makings of great things. I was expecting a flood of hands to fly into the air. I was expecting having difficulty picking and choosing who will respond. But this became the reality for me in America. On two levels, you had to struggle all the time. There was this racial, a very intense racial animus for no reason other than simply the color of your skin and the expectations that go along with that. And I learned also that you couldn't depend on a sympathetic ear from women necessarily. They did not, as in the Caribbean, come to you with a more motherly kind of attitude, wanting to take care of you and to see to you. That did not obtain here. So you learned that you have a two-pronged fight, and you have to be alert at all times because you're very things are in the hands of people who statistically are more likely so you make no distinctions or you are reluctant to make any distinctions when it comes to the fact that, well, you're a woman, and that's a woman sitting across from you, and she would be more sensitive, more amenable to listening to you. It does not work. The women that I encountered were not at all like my mother. Not at all like Mrs. Waterman, who taught me how to write. Not at all like Mrs. King, who taught me how to read. Not at all like any of my neighbors who looked out for me. They had a mean streak to them, generally. They were not kind people. They were not people that I could automatically trust. They were people I had to watch and be careful around. Because in the same way that I was taught to make myself amenable to instruction from others, they were taught that it was their role in life and their right to instruct me, but not for my benefit. I was a grown woman doing my laundry when I first came to Florida, in the laundry room, just like anybody else with laundry to do. A woman, a white woman, came up to me. I'd never met her before. And she said, you know, I was wondering if you can give me a couple of hours a week. I mean, that's the first thing she said to me. And I fell out laughing. Not because it was funny, but because it was just so outrageous. And I laughed the kind of laugh that would make me look and sound like a lunatic. I went out of control just laughing. To the point where I think I frightened this woman. Speaking of frightened, I tell the story a couple of times I've told it. I was called by a magazine that was looking to start up in Manhattan. And I went in for the interview. And it was on Madison Avenue, very posh, but the offices were in construction. And in this little sealed-off area of this vast floor was where the interview occurred, and I'm talking, and we're having preliminary back and forth. And the woman, she was a white woman, interviewing me, popped out of her chair like a jack-in-the-box. She says, I'll be right back. She disappears and comes back with three more people. So now, in this little corner of the room that could barely fairly accommodate two, there were three colleagues of hers. There was her and me, five of us. And she resumed the conversation as if nothing really happened. And she says, well, this is Jutrice Lead, and we were talking. And she picks up the conversation, and it was just essentially a brainstorming of ideas, wanting to know what I was thinking about and so forth. And I responded to the questions that she asked me. And she said, I'll never forget it. She says, what did I tell you? She says to her colleagues. Isn't she frightening? Frightening? I mean, I had been described as many things before. Frightening was never, ever on the list. I checked. My horns were retracted, as was my tail, my claws as well. I did take a shower, so I smelled okay, and combed my hair and brushed my teeth. So what was it that was frightening this woman about me? And then I thought to myself, lady, if I'm frightening you now and we're just having a conversation, if I really had operated at my normal pace, you would open the window and jump through it and kill yourself. What was so frightening? And if, in her view, I was frightening, why would you tell somebody something like that? Except that you couldn't help yourself in dealing with an unexpected surprise, and it just caught you so off guard that your expectations were shattered. And I was just having a normal conversation to be absolutely truthful about it. For the purposes of my discussion with her, I had decelerated considerably so as not to outpace this woman. Just to keep pace with her, I had to come down several notches. And that was frightening. So in my constant contact with women, white women especially, and women in general, I mean, but white women, I came to my own conclusions about what life in the United States would require of me as a kind of defense mechanism linked literally to day-to-day survival. I learned that in the United States, the women who affirm their right, their feminism, if you will, their identity as women, very often have a very skewed idea of what feminism is. A kind of destructive idea. And maybe it is understandable given the society that shaped their views and that shapes their views every day. And what is that society? It's a society that places a great deal of emphasis on domination and control. It is not enough simply to accept people where you meet them and for whom they really are. It is important, even at the outset, to establish dominance, that is to say, superiority or supremacy. And on the flip side, the expectation is that you too accept their dominance and superiority and supremacy, as well as your own inferiority to them. And that is the basis on which relationships, even casual ones, professional relationships, day-to-day relationships, are based. This society had spent a great deal of time and effort and science in the art of dominance and supremacy. And by a class of people who accrued these tools as part of their daily lives, whether they know it or not. The women's movement that grew out of, at least in modern times, grew out of the agitation essentially of African Americans for humanity from the society was essentially launched as a way of white women settling scores with white men. It was kind of an outgrowth of war. I know there are people listening saying, oh my God, what a revisionist historian here. But this is my interpretation of it. From my vantage point and the vantage point of people with whom I identify as a member of the class, the fight essentially was between the white male establishment and the white female establishment, with both sides, while disagreeing with each other, both agreed on the idea of controlling everyone else. Had no problem with that. That was settled. That was a settled thing. You do not find very much literature in the United States of white women rejecting this essential pillar of American society. You find a lot of discussion about patriarchy and the power that goes with it, and the natural resistance to being controlled by men, or having men call the shots, or having men rule. You do not find very much literature that points to a difference with the patriarchy over its racist supremacy over others. And that is, to me, the heart of the matter. In many interviews I've had, I've been asked a question about black men versus black women, the dynamic within the black community between black men and black women. And I frequently upset the interviewers with my answer. I reject these kinds of questions because they attack the one defense that we actually have, and that we have witnessed being so decimated, and that we have so much work to do to restore. And that is the dynamic between black men and black women, black family life, destroyed by the same system that I'm talking about. I do not see black female power as being necessarily a good influence in black community life, not the way it's defined. Not the way that it's defined. I do not segregate black women and black men, because I see they already have been, the job has been done so effectively. I don't need to join the party. We need to impress upon those, and in the feminist world, the people who are guiding the movement, the people who are forming the thrust of this movement, the backbone of the movement, themselves are not given to accepting the differences that cultures exert in the relationships between men and women in family life. For example, in my culture, we reject this business of individualism. It is lethal to our interests. In many corners of the world that say they are very feminist, individualism, like white male individualism, like the white male, the standard approach, political approach, it used to be called rugged individualism. For us, it's a lethal thing. We reject that. And it must be respected that we reject that. It is not helpful to our communities at all. And so feminism has an entirely different construct within our communities. And we are to be in charge of that. In the same way that we would reject the hegemony of white males, we should reject the hegemony of white females who have positioned themselves as the architects of a movement and who, time and again, when we look at the approaches taken with respect to the movement, the forward movement of the whole, we find ourselves coming time and again to this famous fork in the road. The cultural dissonance that compels one group to say, well, it is all right to go this way, and you should go this way, and others who say, no can do, and won't do it. A cultural way of life is valid and important no matter what you think about it. In my own family, I would say I grew up in a traditional Caribbean family. My father had his own sphere of influence and his own way of working. My mother had her own way of working. My father was unquestionably the head of the household, theoretically. We all knew that my mother was actually the head of the household because she had the final word. My father was a big old brazen man, loud and proud, big and brazen. My mother was a very refined and quiet lady, a very demure person. But when she said no, that was the end of it. Even for my big old brazen father. But my father had his role as a man in the household, and we all respected that. He had his own chair. He had his own favorite soup bowl. He had his own part of the house. And he did his job. And his job was to provide. His job was to protect the family. His job was to give a sense of safety and a sense of calm in that safety in the household. He was a businessman. My mother, too, was a business person. And she did her job. She saw to the stasis of the household, that we all looked clean and tidy at all times, that we all had our meals on time, that we were all healthy, that we were all doing our homework and so forth. And the relationship was such that it did not take anything away from her or from us to acknowledge our father as the man of the house. He is running the show. Even though my mother had strong veto power. And together, they worked out a plan to raise 9 crazy children and to put us all on solid footing so that we can have a shot at life. My father used to hold these strange conferences from time to time with us children, and he called them constitutional talks. Yeah, we never discussed a constitution of any sort. In fact, we weren't allowed to talk. But when we grew old enough, he would have sessions, one-on-one. And what did he tell me in the last session that he had with me? I was a teenager, and he told me, you belong to yourself first. You belong to you. You get to decide who you hand the reins of your life to. Do not depend on any man for your future. These are the things he would say. So I grew up with that. And when I encountered the exact opposite in life, just traversing life, and very often with women, and you find that they're so out of sync with that kind of thinking that it is all right to come into the fullness of your own without wanting to also destroy or dominate or control others, without acting like the enemy that you're fighting. And could you please, devote some kind of time to watching out for your own contradictions? Because there are many. In this society, I have found invariably that the white power structure is in full agreement with who ought to be dominated and controlled. They may have differences with each other, but they're clear as to who belongs in the ranks of power and who does not. I haven't found very much divergence in my own travels. I haven't found very much divergence from that basic premise. I haven't found a healthy kind of approach to building constituencies based on respect for culture and for the internal contradictions within the United States that have to be tackled and overcome. And this is one central thing, that there ought to be an entirely different approach. There ought to be. But I'm not waiting. I don't consider myself by any means a shrinking violet of some sort. And I don't consider myself a raging feminist in the sense that people understand feminism. I do not subscribe to this idea of a kind of isolated growth. I subscribe to the idea of an integrated growth, that the power of women is best reflected in the uplift of the communities and the social structures where they live and work. I don't see it as a fight with men, although we are clear we live in a patriarchal society, but that's the way this country was scientifically constructed. So I don't have a war with men. But I do have great differences with men, with the understanding that, like me and like women, we all are conditioned to self-destruct. We all are subject to a very faulty kind of conditioning. And we have to reject it, but without feeling fear that in rejecting it, we also reject this notion of power. Power is an aphrodisiac. We like it. We can't wait for more of it. And the more power we have, the more we want. Because there's something, and this is the aphrodisiac in the business of power, male power, and that is, again, dominance and control. I look at how Hillary Clinton is regarded, and I couldn't find a more repugnant example of womanhood than Hillary Clinton. And yet, people are just can't wait for this woman to rise like a phoenix from the ashes that are the end result of the many things that she has burned, to rise up and take her rightful, predestined, preordained place in the pantheon of power. She's a horrible example of what powerful women should be. And that's a glaring example today to me of what it is, what is wrong with this so-called women's movement. There should be so many people commenting about Hillary Clinton as a perfect example of what we do not want. What is wrong with power? What is wrong with this notion of dominance and control? And yet, there's the exact opposite reaction. Let's embrace her. Let's support her. Let's demand that we put her in the White House so she could be equally as odious as any man we've ever hated. Now, it may sound like I'm super simplifying this thing, but I'm telling you my own reaction to it. So what is feminism to me? I look at feminism, if I have to call it that, I look at it really within the construct, I would say, of a Harriet Tubman or of an Ida B. Wells, that the fight is for the redemption of your group, your oppressed group, and the courage to be inclusive about it. You lead by inclusion, not exclusion. You place yourself within the struggle, and our struggle, and I'm going to insist that the rights of our culture be respected, within our struggle, the redemption is to be directed toward the healing of our families, our communities, and ourselves. The work must reflect a consistent effort to retrieve our own wholeness that for centuries has been damaged. And our work is to consistently lift up the notion that we come from cultures that are all about the aggregate good, aggregate progress, aggregate benefit. No one is more important or more powerful or more lofty than the other. We have a lot of work to do. And the work that we do should speak to the cultural imperative that we have to heal ourselves, to heal our communities, to heal our children, to heal our families, not to separate us, not to separate ourselves as I'm the black woman and you the black man kind of thing. No, we are people. We are a society. And the same work has to be done in the white communities and in Latino communities. Fortunately, even as desperate as the situation is, we still have enough of the remnants of our original cultural imperatives to hold on to that could help us through this. But we don't need more and more people signing on to this individualistic approach and this power grab for power's sake, and to misinterpret power as the preferred way to heal a community or a nation. You've got to have power, but it has to be wise power, judicious power. It has to be confluent with the aggregate good. So those are my thoughts. I am not by any means decrying the desire of women, white women, or all women, to find their place. Because to a large extent, as I said, we all live in a society that has its rules, that has its history, a lot of it bad, a lot of it counterproductive, a lot of it actually lethal to a good life, a full life, a just life. So we always have to be on guard. I caution that we carefully examine this notion of power and how it is to be attained and ultimately how it is to be used. And I also caution that we do not take the formulaic approach, because we see already the formula is being devised by people who are not connected to my culture or your culture. It is connected to their culture, and that's the problem. The culture is itself a problem. It is not a life-sustaining culture. It's not a just culture. It is not a culture that enhances life and cooperation. It is a culture that preaches dominance and control of fracturing things, destroying things, pitting people against each other. That is not a good culture. So, develop your sense of power within the context of your culture. And if we find a movement that celebrates that, I'm all with it. I'm good. I'll go with it. But until then, I'm content to be left to my own devices. I'm content to seek out the answers that lie within instructions that I have been given in my culture. I'm content to proceed according to what I was taught. A lot of it, of course, we have to tweak. But essentially, like they say with a house, it's got good bones, a good structure, a good basic foundation. And I cherish that. And I won't let anybody persuade me that it's no longer useful or good. Thanks so much for joining me today. And thank you for the opportunity to share my thoughts with you. I appreciate it. You can always reach me at leadstories@gmail.com, on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. Let me know what you're thinking. Let me know how these programs are resonating with you. Coming up next, Richard Wolff with Economic Update. Keep it right here on PRN.FM. And tomorrow, we go to Ferguson. Bye-bye.
I had enough.